The Jeep Grand Cherokee 4xe plug-in hybrid is built for the best of both worlds. For the city buzz, for the call of the wild, for finding solitude, for sharing memories, for day trips, and for far-roaming adventures. Because with gas and electric capability, the Jeep Grand Cherokee 4xe inspires you to explore more, to explore it all. Tap the banner to learn more. Jeep is a registered trademark of FCA US LLC.
CeraVe facial moisturizers with SPF protect skin against damaging UV rays and continuously deliver three essential ceramides to help restore skin's protective barrier so it can lock in moisture. Non-greasy, fragrance-free, and won't clog pores? With CeraVe, skin feels hydrated and looks healthy all day. CeraVe facial moisturizers with SPF from the number one dermatologist recommended facial moisturizer brand.
Allstate wants to remind fans that mayhem is everywhere. Like when your fantasy league meets up at your house. Everything's great until the hot plate gets too hot for the tablecloth. Now your kitchen's up in smoke. And if you don't have the right home insurance coverage, the cost to fix this is anything but a fantasy. So switch to Allstate, save money, and get protected from mayhem like this. Not available in every state. Based on coverage selected, subject to terms, conditions, and availability. Savings vary.
Today's podcast is presented by Podgo. Podgo is the easiest way for you to monetize your podcast, providing podcasters with a flat rate for ad space so you always know how much you get when you include an ad from Podgo. I recently joined as a member and you can too. Apply today to become a member and immediately be connected with advertisers that fit your audience. That's podgo.co at podgo.co. And remember to include the name The Scoreless Thriller Podcast in your application. Thank you.
Man there trying to stop Drunk from getting himself into further trouble. It's a fucking disgrace.
Oh, it's not a bad ball for Pelé on the right side. It's Carlos Alberto. And what a great goal that was! Carlos Alberto!
Maradona just walked away from Huddle then. Maldano smoked and...
In de halve finale gaan komen met het balbezit voor Frank de Boer. Frank de Boer speelt de bal heel goed naar Dennis Bergkamp. Dennis Bergkamp! Dennis Bergkamp neemt de bal aan! Dennis Bergkamp!
Dennis Bergkamp! Dennis Bergkamp! Dennis Bergkamp! Dennis Bergkamp!
Oh! Frank de Boer speelt de bal naar Dennis Bergkamp! Die neemt de bal feilloos aan! En hij schiet de bal erin!
Hello. And welcome to the Scoreless Thriller Podcast. I'm Alex and joined as always by Leon. Leon, how are you doing?
I'm doing great. Thanks.
And we've got a guest today. We're joined by Manny. Manny Jasmine. Manny, thank you so much for joining us on the podcast.
Hi, Alex. Hi, Leon. Thanks very much for inviting me.
So Manny is the host of the BBC World Football Podcast and a football journalist, sports journalist with the BBC. At this point, I think it would be good for you to sort of introduce yourself a bit further for our listeners. So what is your sort of sports journalism journey, or how did you kind of end up in that field and working for the BBC?
Well, I've been a journalist for almost 20 years now, and I was freelance for the first half of that, combining sport, or mostly working at the BBC, combining sport with other issues. But I've been working exclusively on world football since 2011, and I've been a reporter on the programme. I've been a producer, and now I'm lucky enough to present it.
Yeah, from what I really enjoy about listening to the BBC, like to the World Football Podcast, is the sort of variety you get from week to week. You know, when I tune in, I don't know whether that's going to be about Namibian football or it's going to be about Brazilian or something else. You know, I just think the variety. How do you sort of try to bring those stories together? What is your kind of thought process when you kind of source the different stories that you want to cover on it?
Well, our aim is always to tell people something they don't know or they might not know. So we avoid really talking about the Premier League or the Champions League or, you know, the Big Five leagues. We do sometimes, but very rarely. So we won't, you know, we won't go into depth about Frank Lampard getting sacked this week. We won't go into depth about Liverpool's problems and all that stuff. You know, because it's the program's called World Football. And luckily for us, in terms of telling people something they don't know, most people concentrate on the list of things that I've told you that we don't want to talk about. So that gives us about 99% of football to work with. And so it's just a question of being tuned in to what's going on in the world and just having a it's not a sort of thing you can, I don't think it's the sort of thing you can do if you're not really, really interested in it personally. You know, to just go there and sift through football in low profile areas of the world, you really have to want to know and care about what's going on in the corners of the football world that don't have a light shining on them all the time. Luckily, I am that interested. And
when did this start?
Say again?
When did this start, the interest in football?
Oh, well, I suppose when I was in primary school, when I was 8 or 9, you know, my friends and, you know, we'd be playing football at break time and things like that. And then I suppose because I wasn't born here, I was born in Iran. I wasn't born in the UK. So I've always been aware of being kind of not being from anywhere, really. So that's given me an awareness of the world. I remember, you know, the sticker albums that you used to get. I had a sticker album for the 1990 World Cup. And where you put the stickers, there was a little bit of information about the player, who they played for and things like that. And I thought it was so exotic to hear about all these clubs around the world that I had no idea about. And ever since then, really, I wanted to know about them. And so really, what I'm doing now is pretty much what I did when I was a teenager, just finding out about football all over the place. But luckily now, I can talk about it on the radio.
Yeah. What has been with some of like the stories that you've really enjoyed covering over the past year or so? I've listening in to the podcast, something I've really enjoyed the recent reuniting of Pat Nevin Namibia with Pat Nevin Scottish.
Yeah, that was that had nothing to do with me, actually. That was the producer who plucked Namibian Pat Nevin out of the air. But in the last year, I mean, when the pandemic happened, we did think, what are we going to talk about? Because, you know, all football stopped. But of course, footballers, just like everyone else, it was a great leveler, actually, the pandemic, in terms of everyone's lives, because it didn't matter if you were a footballer in your own sort of, I was going to say bubble, but I meant bubble in the pre-pandemic sense, as in just kind of locked away in your own world in your gated mansion, or if you're just an ordinary guy. Everyone was going through exactly the same thing. And so we had loads of material to work with. And because everyone was sort of caught out by the pandemic, and nobody really knew what to do about it, the club press officers weren't anywhere near as strict and suspicious and controlling as they normally are. So we were able to call up these players at home and just talk about the things that were affecting their lives, which were exactly the same things that were affecting everyone else's lives. And I remember one guy, a Spanish footballer, who was a journeyman, really, and his club was in Thailand, but he couldn't. He went to Spain for Christmas in 2019, and he couldn't get back to Thailand because of their lockdown in East Asia. And he happened to have a pharmacy degree, and his parents were pharmacists, they're quite elderly. So he just started working in the pharmacy, and he was serving all these people. And, you know, Spain was, at that time, this is sort of April time, was very much in the teeth of the pandemic. And there were no masks, there were no protective equipment. And he was there, facing all these people every day, trying to give them medicine, trying to give them help. His wife was heavily pregnant. He was training at home by lifting up 5-liter bottles of water. That was his training in the evenings while he worked in the pharmacy by day. It was an amazing story. But there were lots of stories like that. And, you know, as I said, yeah, we were all, wherever we were, whatever we did, we were all kind of suffering in the same way.
Yeah, there's this common frame of reference that you then suddenly have. But there's also some sort of difference, right? Because the big leagues, for example, in England or Germany, they can afford to have testing all the time and to invest in the infrastructure to create this kind of safe zone within the stadiums and within the teams, which is probably not the case everywhere in the world, right?
That's true. I mean, the picture has changed with testing. And, you know, once testing became a thing, then there was definitely a discrepancy between the haves and the have-nots within football. I mean, you know, women's football, nothing happened in women's football for a long time last year. And as you rightly say, you know, I mean, in England, Premier League clubs are tested every week. I think they're doing it twice a week now. Whereas lower down, even still in professional football, there are hardly any tests. And it's only when clubs were tested because they were in the FA Cup that they uncovered so many cases of coronavirus. So, yeah, I mean, you know, the familiar old lines of those who have and those who have not emerged within the context of coronavirus. But to begin with, everyone was in the same boat.
Yeah. Exactly. I also wanted to bring up, so I read an article about you which says that the first line in your CV reads the first male journalist to be allowed into any kind of women's football in Iran. Would you be able to tell, how did that come about? How were you able to have this sort of claim to fame, or how was this situation arise?
Well, this was I think it was back in 2004 or 2005, I went to Iran and I was trying to interview the old Iranian striker Ali Daei because he was about to become the first man to score 100 international goals. And I interviewed him and he did it in some style. He went from 98 to 102 in one match. But while I was there, I thought, well, what about women's football? Who plays women's football in Iran? And I was put in touch with a coach of a club in Tehran, and I called her up and we had a chat. And I said, can I come to one of your training sessions and just do some recording? And she said, well, how are you going to do that? You're a man. And I said, well, I think there are two reasons why you should let me. One is that I've come all the way from London, and two is that I can't see anything, I'm blind. And she sort of thought about it, and she said, fair enough, all right then.
Solid arguments on both.
Yeah, exactly. So so off I went. My male relatives were seething with jealousy because you had all these young girls running around in shorts and t-shirt, and I was there, although the great leveler was that I couldn't see them just as much as they couldn't see them, because they were where I was. So that's how it happened. And you know, protocols, the coach's personal protocols didn't change. I mean, she didn't guide me anywhere. She wouldn't let me hold her arm. She would just sort of shout. She would walk ahead and shout to make sure I was following her that way, which I quite respected, actually. But nevertheless, there it was.
Yeah, it's an incredible story. Like, speaking more generally then, so we're going to move on to the main topic and why I wanted to get in touch in the first place, which was you wrote this article for the BBC Sport website, which I encourage everyone to check out, about the historic sort of attempted a peace match between Iran and USA in 2000. Now, the two teams met in the World Cup in 1998. Do you have any specific memories of either that game or the game in 2000?
Well, yes, in 98, I watched it on TV in England, and it was, if it hadn't been for Iran, the way they qualified for that World Cup, that would be probably my best football memory. But Iran qualified for that World Cup in remarkable circumstances when they beat Australia on away goals. And you should do a podcast about that separately. But that was amazing. And I think all Iran fans who remember that time would put that as their favorite memory. But
in what way? I don't remember. Iran got a late goal, or was,
well, it's just because never mind the build up and what went on in the build up, but I mean, there were no FIFA days at that time in 97, and so the Asian World Cup qualifiers happened every week between September and the end of November. It was like a league, but the prize was qualifying for the World Cup. And Iran were, at the halfway stage, Iran were top of the group on course. But then, as usually happened, it put Iranians together for long enough and they'd all fall out with them. So they all fell out, and the coach was sacked. And then they had a... After all these games, the eight weeks of games, home and away, they had a one-leg playoff against Japan in Malaysia. And it went to extra time. It was 2-2, and Ali Dai hit the post in the 119th minute. And from the rebound, Japan counterattacked, went down the other end and scored the winner with the golden goal. So, and then 6 days later in Tehran, they played the first leg of the final playoff against Australia, which finished 1-1. And a week later, they went to Melbourne and played Australia in the MCG. 90,000 people there. And in the first 10 minutes, being conservative, Australia should have been 5-0 up.
Yeah.
they weren't. They only went 2-0 up. And then a fan ran on the pitch and pulled down the goal net. And this was a guy who, it was a guy called Peter Hoare, who made a habit of disrupting sports.
He was everywhere, right? I think I remember some Olympic thing as well.
And... Yeah. He was.
Heard of him.
so he ran on, pulled down the goal net, and stopped the game. And that's really, that was the turning point in the match. Iran only had three chances in the game, and they scored from two of them. And they went through on away goals. Anyway, I said I wasn't going to go into it, but I just had.
No, please.
Anyway, that's why the win over the United States at France 98 was the second best football moment in our memories.
Yeah.
But that was, I mean, you know, before that game in France 98, obviously that was a hugely sensitive political match, for all the reasons that have been pretty much the same for the last 40 years in terms of the enmity between Iran and USA. But, you know, before the game, Bill Clinton gave a presidential address just because of that game. And, you know, the players, the Iran players, you know, if you look it up on YouTube, you'll see all the gifts that they showered the Americans with. And in that game as well, I think America hit the post three times.
Mm-hmm.
But Iran ended up winning 2-1. And inside the stadium, I did a report about this match a few years ago. And inside the stadium, there were different Iranian factions in the stands. People who were monarchists, people who were sort of Republicans as supporting of the current regime. Another group that hated both of those first two groups, and they were all having a go at each other. They weren't even, a lot of people weren't there to support the football team. And so, and that transmitted itself to the players. And so it wasn't a very happy occasion for the players because of that reason. Nevertheless, after that game, a friend of mine called Mehdad Masoudi, who was the FIFA media officer at the match, met up with, or he bumped into, Hank Steinbrecher, who was the general secretary of US soccer, and he said, well, let's do it again. And Hank Steinbrecher said, well, he said to me, you know, Mehdad wanted to do it for humanitarian reasons and building bridges and all that stuff. Hank Steinbrecher said, look, they kicked our ass.
Yes.
that was his motivation. And eventually they had to overcome so many hurdles and barriers and so many people who didn't want the game to happen in the United States, but they stuck at it and they got this game on that hardly anyone knows anything about, because it's just friendly. It was a friendly in January, when the USA usually picks sort of second string players. And I mean, this was back in 2000. You know, my parents didn't have internet at home. They certainly didn't have any kind of satellite TV that showed it. So I knew it was on, but I had to wait a week to go back to university to go online and find out what the score had been.
Well,
yeah, I think the only footage I could find on YouTube was like, there's like a 40 second highlight package, yeah, and then that's it.
I know. Yeah. It's remarkable when you think of it now. You could watch the game in about five different languages on various illegal streams.
But yeah.
No, in those days I had to wait a week to find out what the score was.
But the people organizing the game, were they like, what kind of effect did they think the game would have? Did they think that it would have actually a major effect on diplomatic relations, or?
Well, I think they were really kind of inspired by the World Cup game, because the World Cup game, you know, it didn't change the political atmosphere, but it certainly brought the societies together a bit closer together, the Iranian and the American societies, because there were so many Iranian fans in the stadium who were, you know, who don't conform or didn't conform to the stereotype of, you know, hardline Islamic, you know, doer, very sort of cold people that seems to exist amongst, you know, for people who don't know anything about Iranians. So, you know, that kind of broke the ice, really, was for a lot of Westerners in terms of how they viewed Iran. And I think the guys who came up, I think Mehdad and Hank who came up with it, just wanted to sort of, they didn't want it to end there. They wanted it to happen again and see what could happen. But the difference was that with the World Cup match, it was the World Cup. It was FIFA's thing. It was in the framework of this behemoth tournament Iran would never boycott the tournament to avoid playing the USA. Never, ever. So it had to happen, and it did happen. Whereas this was just a friendly. This was down to the will of so many different people, and that was totally different. Originally, they were going to play the game in 99 in Washington, but that was a big no-no for the Iranian government. And when I say the Iranian government, I'm really talking about the supreme leader, because the president has fairly limited range of powers. You know, everything comes from the supreme leader. And having a game, you know, he didn't want Iranians to go to Washington, you know, the home of the White House, to play there. It was symbolically sensitive. So eventually they settled on a tour, a three-game tour of California. Iran also played Ecuador, Mexico, and ended with the USA in the Pasadena Rose Bowl. But before they, you know, I mean, I'm saying it like it was just a question of people getting their diaries together and sort of.
Yeah,
but it wasn't at all. I mean, there was an issue of fingerprinting Iranians when they got to America. All Iranians were fingerprinted and photographed, and the Iran side said, "No, we're not going to do that. So if that's going to happen, then we're not going to come." So then U.S. soccer had to go to the Homeland Security and say, look, can you waive this? And they wouldn't waive it. And I'm not entirely clear on this, because people have been quite coy about how high up the chain of command it went before it was waived. But I think the feeling I get was it went up very high in the US administration to get this waiver. So they got this waiver, and the Iran team flew to Chicago via Frankfurt, and there's a guy called Tom King who was basically the US soccer's fixer, and you know, they had if they had a friendly, he would sort out the hotels and all that stuff. And he went to Frankfurt to meet the Iran team, and he got there, and one of the players said to him, who was based in Germany, said, that I just have to go and give my key back to my landlord because I'm moving house. Is that all right? He said, what are you on about? We're in the transit zone. If you go out, you won't come back in.
Well, what happened then?
So, I mean, you have to remember, Tom was there with lots of privileges and lots of security passes. So he negotiated with the security that this guy can come back. But he also jotted down a disclaimer that if this doesn't work out, it's not my fault. So the player went off to see his landlord.
Get his deposit back.
Exactly, yeah.
Hopefully. I mean, you never know.
And then about 20 minutes before they were due to board, the desk said to Tom that half of the delegation, their tickets hadn't been paid for. And Tom was thinking, well, who's going to pay for it? And this was like 2 or 3 in the morning US time. So he thought, well, I can't call anyone. No one's going to answer the phone now. So he thought, right, what's the limit on my credit card? And am I going to get this money back? And he just went for it, and he paid for it himself.
That's quite an investment.
Yeah. I mean, talk about making sure you put the receipt somewhere safe so you can pay it back. So eventually got them on board, and they flew to Chicago, got to Chicago. They were going through customs. First guy in the delegation turned up to immigration, and they said, right, I need your fingerprints.
Oh, no.
And then the head of delegation said, right, you lied to us. We're going back. We're not staying this. And Tom said, no, calm down. He just sort of whipped out this letter that he had from someone from Chicago immigration to get them through. So they got through, without any problems. And then they started this 10-day tour. They played these two games. They had a bit of tourism. You know, they went to Universal Studios, and they went to Disneyland, and did loads of shopping, things like that. But as the closer the game got, the more tense things became, and some of the players and the coach were getting calls to the hotel rooms, saying either offering bribes for them not to do the match, or threatening them if they did. The head of the Iranian FA got a call saying, if you go ahead with this match, we'll make sure your flight home doesn't make it, things like that. And this was from a group that nobody had ever heard of. It was just a quite spurious group. And I think they were traced to somewhere in Texas in the end. And the head of the FA, Safai Farahani, said, well, look, you know, everyone in Iran knows where I am. They've all got the hotel number. If they want to call me, they can. You're not calling on behalf of them. I don't believe you.
Yeah.
What a theory that the sponsoring of the game by Budweiser was the issue. So the US soccer, Hank Steinbrecher, whom I mentioned earlier, he said, look, don't worry, we can get another sponsor. But his counterpart said, no, you know, you've signed this deal with them. We're both professionals. You go ahead, carry on with Budweiser as the sponsor. Nevertheless, the FBI took these threats very seriously. So they had a decoy Iran team bus outside the hotel, which they filled with random people and drove off to the stadium on the day of the match. And the actual Iran players, they smuggled through the hotel kitchens into the underground car park where the actual team bus was waiting. And they followed a bit later on. So you ended up with two Iran team buses at the stadium.
So action-packed.
Wow. Yeah, I know. And this is just for friendly. And what I found particularly chilling, and I didn't know until I'd started to research this article, was that they were afraid that someone might fly a plane into the stadium. And this is 18 months before 9/11 happened. So they shut off the airspace around the stadium so that nobody would fly into the stadium. And, you know, by all accounts, outside the stadium, the atmosphere was amazing. People were making kebabs and everyone was mingling. And, you know, I think all but a few hundred fans were Iranians. It absolutely just...
Because there's a huge Iranian community in Los Angeles, right? I think
there is, yeah. Yeah. I mean, at least 500,000 people live there. But they also came, I mean, I spoke to a fan who flew there from Colorado, and he was saying, you know, in Colorado, you hardly see any Iranians, but every time I turned a corner, I saw a bloke I knew who had also gone there. And after all of that, after all these events and problems, it was only 1-1. You think the players just kind of should have done something to create some kind of memorable scoreline.
But although it does sound very diplomatic.
It's almost fixed, do you feel? If it's 1-1.
Yeah, exactly. In fact, I spoke to one of the guys who's on the bench for the USA. I interviewed him about something else last year, but I said, by the way, I'm doing this article. And he said, I can't even remember if I played. So that's how memorable it was for them. Mm.
But how about for the Iranian players? I mean, for them traveling over to America, do they have many misgivings about the tour or the game taking place?
I don't know. I mean, in that squad, a sizable chunk of those players were already playing in Europe. In fact, one of the players, the captain, was already playing in America. He was playing for New York, New Jersey Metro Stars. So you know, there was no question of, you know, defecting or being starstruck. I mean, they, you know, they, as I said, they went to Universal Studios and Disneyland, but, you know, people who'd never been to America, many people would do that. You know, they were never going to defect because they had too much to lose, because in Iran, they were superstars, well paid. And as I said, many of them already lived in Germany. So why defect to go to America when you're already living in the West? I don't think it was a big deal in that sense for them. And I don't think, I'm sure they weren't as affected by the significance of playing the USA as, you know, as observers might have thought them to be. And as I say, in terms of the games, they were very low key. I mean, they played Ecuador's under 23s, Mexico's sort of B team, and the B team from USA. So it wasn't, you know, they weren't games that had huge profile around the world.
But they were politically incredibly spicy. But beyond the restraints or the doubts within the regime or within the government of Iran, how were the reaction within the society there? I mean, before the match, but also afterwards, was it even a thing after the World Cup 1998, like another friendly match? Or did people actually...
I've never heard anyone bring this second game up.
Okay.
You know, the 98 World Cup was huge, the game that they played there. And, you know, people flooded the streets afterwards and celebrated and all that stuff. This game will have been, I suppose, around midnight, something like that, in Iran. And, you know, people will remember it happening. But it has no place in their personal histories of Iranian football. It's not in the list of momentous matches that Iran played.
Yeah, as somebody who spent much of your life living outside of Iran, what is your kind of personal or like relationship to the national team? Do you find yourself desperately watching their results, or does it, as time goes by, you're less connected?
Oh no, I have my club and I have my national team, and Iran and my national team. You know, I think as time has gone on, I've been less committed to their friendlies and things like that, partly because they happen in the middle of the day in the UK time, and I'm busy working. But no, I mean, I was in South Korea when they qualified for the Brazil World Cup, and you know, I was choking back tears in the press conference after the match.
Yeah.
I went to the last World Cup for work, and paid for tickets from a tout to watch Iran's first game against Morocco. And it was an awful game. It was terrible. Iran won right at the end, 1-0. And I did cry then. So I'm very much invested in the national team.
How are they doing at the moment? How are they doing at the moment since the last World Cup?
Well, it's all a bit kind of, everything's kind of ground to a halt because of the pandemic. But they're in a bit of a pickle, actually, in terms of qualifying for the next World Cup. The top two from each group at the current round goes through to the next round, which is the final round.
Yeah,
they're currently third. The thing that's in their favour is that there are four games left, and three of them are in Iran.
Mm-hmm.
But I suppose playing in an empty stadium, that sort of takes the edge off that. But yeah, they need to pull their fingers out and stop messing around, because if they're not careful, they'll be knocked out.
But from the people that you spoke to about this Iran USA game from 2000, what did they say for like its legacy? Did they feel that it had some kind of impact, or were they just like, oh, it happened and things went on as they had been?
I think they recognized that they were quite naive to think that it would have a legacy or it would have some kind of humanitarian impact, because it didn't. But I think they're very proud of the fact that they got the show on,
yeah,
and they made it happen, because it was quite a feat to make this happen. And you know, in a weird way, they sort of brought the two governments into each other's orbit, because they were at some level both working on this project, you know, either to try and stop it or try and help it go ahead. No, I mean, it didn't have a legacy. As I say, it's a match and an occasion that, you know, has passed out of memory in terms of football fans around the world. And I think they're sad about that, but I think they're proud that it happened. There was talk of a rematch of the USA going to Iran. And these were, in those days, you know, Iran's president was a reformist. Bill Clinton was coming to the end, and you know, he was more open to diplomacy than Donald Trump certainly was. And so there was, you know, it wasn't unrealistic to ask the USA to go to Iran. And there was a tournament in 2001 in Iran called the Civilization Cup. And it was a 4-team tournament. Iran were there, Egypt, a couple of other. It was basically, you know, the old world, all the countries.
Yeah.
Civilization. And they were going to invite Greece, and the USA were going to be representing the new world. But I think they asked, their appearance fee was too high, so it didn't happen. But it could have happened. And there's a sort of outstanding return date that hasn't been filled. And there are still people in US soccer who are working there now, who were working there when this game went on. So it may well be that it's an itch that needs to be scratched for some people. And
yeah,
who knows in the next 4 years if there might be a possibility to make that happen.
Yeah, might not have gotten more likely in the last couple of years that this could happen, I guess.
Well, I think it's been less likely in the last few
years. Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, you know, there are whispers that I haven't really been able to substantiate that a game might have gone ahead in Qatar a couple of years ago. But you know, didn't. And then, in fact, I think the game was supposed to happen last year. I think it was mooted 2 years ago. It was supposed to happen last year. But then the USA assassinated Iran's top general, and they were actually supposed to have a training camp in Qatar this time last year. And all of that was rearranged for security reasons. So yeah, it's unlikely, but you never know.
Just speaking generally, in your experience of covering sort of stories which deal with kind of, if you like to imagine it, like the diplomacy through football, is there some examples where you feel that it has actually had positive effects, or do you feel like it's usually just the game happens, everyone shakes hands, and then it goes back to exactly how it was before?
Well, I think most of the time that is what happens, I'm afraid. I mean, a couple of weeks ago, I spoke to Rildo, who was who's the former captain of Santos when Pelé was playing for Santos. And, you know, they were going on all sorts of tours around the world. And he said that they went to Nigeria and, you know, they were a bit worried about their safety because it was the middle of the Nigerian civil war. And the generals met with Pelé and they said, no, don't worry, you'll be safe. we're gonna suspend the war while you play, and then after the game, when you've gone, we'll carry on again. And he said, "Well, how do I know that's going to be the truth? That's true." And the general said, "No, it is true, because all the generals want to go to the match." So I suppose in that sense, football did have some sort of
brief.
Briefly, yeah. Stop the war for a little while. But, you know, politics goes so much deeper than a match or a tournament. That, you know, I think it's simplistic and naive to think that, you know, the next, you know, politically sensitive game that happens will have some kind of lasting impact on the two countries' political issues.
Yeah, but maybe if it goes beyond a single game, if it's more about sports in general or football in general, or these huge events that you have when you've got a football World Cup, or maybe the Olympic Games, do you think that on the greater scale they can have an impact on international cooperation, people getting to know people from different areas of the world, of interacting with them? Or do you think they're mostly just used as propaganda tools to show a certain vision that you want to be seen of your country to the world?
Well, I think, as I said, the game between Iran and USA in 98 had that impact. It did sort of open people's eyes up to Iranians, and you know, they saw Iranians as being fun loving and you know,
cheering the team on,
excited
about the match, having exactly the same feelings.
Yeah, exactly. And a lot of Iranians, you know, had the Iran flag painted on one side of their face and the USA flag painted on the other side.
Yeah.
So I suppose that did, but in terms of, you know, a sport. You know, even in the Olympics, Iranian wrestlers meet USA wrestlers usually at some stage in the Olympics, and boxing and things like that. And, you know, these things come and go. And, you know, I'm not an aficionado of wrestling, but one of the USA's biggest names, which is a name that I've forgotten, so that's...
No worries.
He's probably not listening to this podcast. If he's listening, please don't email us.
Yeah, He'll be so offended.
I can't remember his name, but I can remember his Twitter feed. His Twitter handle is All I See Is Gold.
Oh, that's a very memorable... That's a good one. Now I see why you remember that one, not his name.
Yeah. But, he's very flamboyant, very cocky American. And he's been to Iran to, you know, to take part in competitions, and he said, "Oh, yeah, I love Iranians and things like that." But that doesn't really cut through, because you're talking about 40 years of political enmity and suspicion. And just because a wrestler says he likes Iranian wrestlers, it doesn't really make any difference.
I've got his name. He's Jordan Burroughs. So Jordan Burroughs. If you're listening, please don't come and put me in a headlock or Manny for that matter.
By Jordan.
Yeah. No, it's true. But I guess the story does tell though that it's always interwoven, right? These sports events. And even if it's just a friendly match between Iran and the US, it definitely plays on different scales and different levels. And you have political actors dominating the turn of events and everything, right?
I think the politics affect the fixture more than the other way around, actually.
Okay, yeah.
Definitely. I mean, as I say, it took a lot for this game that we're talking about to happen. So the build-up to it was significant, but the aftermath was pretty non-existent.
Although to some extent it is a political gamble, right? Of course, you can facilitate the match and make it happen, but then at least that's the idea. You don't know what comes out of it, right? As in the final results and how this plays.
Well, there is that. There is the issue of the potential of being embarrassed by losing. I think, as I say, at the time, in terms of this America-Iran game, at the time, the atmosphere was a lot more conducive to this sort of thing. I think, you know, Iran would never play Israel. And I think the potential for losing, even though it would be unlikely because Israel aren't very good, the potential for losing to Israel would be too much for the current regime in Iran to risk agreeing to a match.
Yeah.
I mean, apart from all the other things, apart from the fact that they don't even recognise Israel and Iranian athletes aren't allowed to compete against them. If you sweep that to one side, I think, you know, potential for losing and being embarrassed, as they would see it, would be too much for them to sanction again.
But isn't that also somewhat of a beauty of your job? That through covering football somewhat away from maybe the mainstream, you get to use it as a vehicle to also talk about the politics, the societal issues, and everything that happens around the world.
Absolutely. And working on the World Service, you know, which is essentially a news network covering the world. I mean, you know, these issues are on the World Service all the time. The issues of politics and geopolitics and things like that, and you know, football fits into that framework, and it always has from right at the beginning when international football was being taken seriously, because you know, nobody around the world really cares who the prime minister of this country or president of that country is and what their policy is on this or that. And you know, being realistic and being brutally honest, not many people really care about the refugee camps and who's in there and why they're in there. But the football team is the national, the country's football team is something that people can relate to and understand. And so, you know, I think that's one of the reasons why games become tied up with politics, because, you know, it's one flag against another and you don't really think about the nuances of the politics behind it. You just see, oh wow, Iran against America, and it's almost dressed up as a kind of war itself. And you expect, you know, the people in the build-up to start talking about who's going to attack who first. It's just a football match, but because it's flag against flag, everything else that exists between those two countries is rolled into this pie, and it becomes more than a match.
No, I understand. I think that's a very well good way of putting it. Manny, I think it's been an absolute pleasure having you on the podcast, and it's been really interesting going a deep dive into this game. What interesting, if you want to plug any interesting projects or what's coming up and you're working on at the moment?
Well, not much, Alex, to be honest with you. We're talking on a Monday. We record World Football on a Thursday. So this question was really better place for a Wednesday evening.
We'll call you again then.
Somebody's a bit of a crammer, it feels like.
it's far too early in the week to know what we're doing.
That is a very fair point.
Yeah. But how can people find you? What is your Twitter handle?
My Twitter handle is at @BBC_Manny. Our program World Football is available as a podcast that usually comes out every Thursday evening UK time, we're on various times on the World Service on Thursdays, Fridays and Saturdays. But if you want to listen to the program, I thoroughly recommend it.
Likewise,
download the podcast.
All right, Manny, thanks so much for your insights and telling us your story today. It's been an absolute pleasure.
Thanks, guys. I really enjoyed it. Thanks for having me.
Sports Social Podcast Network.